Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
His whole being at that time seeped into the tape and then comes out of your speakers and goes right into you.
Hello, everybody. This is the Rockin' the Suburbs podcast. My name is Patrick Foster. On behalf of my co-host and longtime friend and co-founder Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you to this episode. And I want to welcome my good friend, I'm proud to call a good friend, and a longtime participant in this podcast, Scott Parks. How are you, man?
I'm good. How are you, Patrick?
Doing well. So tell us, you had an idea. I don't know, we batted this idea around a few times, but tell everybody what we're going to tee up here.
Yeah, so in the past, I've, you know, been on the podcast several times, and I've done three different stints on the podcast covering a range of albums from different artists. So we've done the Kinks twice. So I did the Arista years, and we did the RCA years, and we did Neil Young in the 80s. So, you know, a lot of these things that I've done are periods of an artist's career that maybe aren't looked upon as highly as some of their either earlier output or possibly later output, not in, in regards to Kinks and Neil Young, but even though his later output got a little bit more, you know, love than the 80s. So whenever I think it was the Neil Young 80s when that dropped, someone had said, you need to do this more often. How about Lou Reed in the 80s? And at that point, I really wasn't that well-versed in 80s Lou Reed. And so over the course of time, I've listened to more and more 80s Lou Reed. Before this, though, I did find three of these albums in a store for $2 each, which was incredible. I had never listened to them. But so what we're going to talk about is Lou Reed, his 1980s albums. And I think we're going to split it up into maybe two episodes because the first three of these six albums kind of follow an arc. And then the second three follow an arc, even though that arc might not be an arc. It might be more of a little dip and then back up. So, yeah, Lou Reed's 1980s discography is what we're going to talk about.
Love it. And, you know, it's such an interesting point you bring up about finding those records, because I think the reason I have most of these 80s records is you could find them in the $3 to $5 bins, right? I mean, they always kind of seem to be there. So,
yeah.
You know, with maybe one or two exceptions, you know, the 70s stuff, not so much. And even the 90s stuff, which I think originally was on CD, you know, it's not as easy to find all that stuff. But this 80s stuff, it's really interesting. And it starts off with an album that was released in 1980. And it was the last one he did for Arista Records. And it's called Growing Up in Public.
Correct. Yeah. And it's kind of at the beginning of a change in his life, too. And I think maybe Growing Up in Public kind of gives you a hint of what this is kind of like. I think he's feeling like he is now a grown up in quotation marks.
Yeah.
You know, through the 70s and the late 60s, he was, you know, either considered himself homosexual or he was at least androgynous. And now come to find out in 1980, he gets married and is now like a kind of a family man to a certain extent. And you get that on this album. And the sound is a lot different. I mean, 2 years before this, he releases Street Hassle, which is dirty and grimy, and it's like late 70s New York, which I absolutely love that sound.
Yeah, it's great.
And this is as far away from that, almost as far away from that as you could possibly get. So I you know, again, I think he's just kind of reached a point in his life. He is, I think, 38 at this point, if I remember correctly. And, you know, so yeah, it's a definitely a different album, different sounding album than what he had released in the 70s.
Yeah, and it's a great outline too, man, because when you look at it, you see that the producer of this album, along with Lou, is a guy named Michael Fonfara, and he is a keyboardist, you know, known for a sound that's, gosh, I don't know, to me it almost reminds me of like, I don't know, Miami Vice-ish kind of a keyboard sound.
Listening to this record, you know what I heard?
I heard what? Meatloaf.
Is that right? Interesting.
There,
yeah.
There are some songs that are like, they're kind of theatrical to a certain extent. And it's that late 70s, early 80s, like, you know, arena rock sound. I'm not saying the whole thing is, because there's some songs that, that sound a lot like Lou. But I think you can tell the songs that Michael Funfara had more of a... an input on. I think those are the ones that kind of are more keyboard based and just more synth based versus the less stripped down with, you know, Lou talk singing over incredible guitar chords and bass. And just like all every other Lou Reed album, the bass playing on this album is awesome.
Yep.
I love basically the bass. I'm always kind of go towards the bass for some reason. I wish I probably should have learned how to play the bass, to be honest with you. But bass playing on this one is really good. I can't remember who the bass player is. Bass player is Ellard Moose Bowles.
There it is. Yep.
But yeah, it's a great sounding album, even though it does sound a little dated, in my personal opinion.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, that it was recorded in the Caribbean. I mean, it's recorded at George Martin's studio in... Montserrat, and that's not a place I can really imagine Lou. You know, like, I can't imagine Lou like in the Caribbean, like wearing shorts or anything. It just seems weird to me.
But if you look at the cover of the album, it doesn't look like a Lou Reed. I mean, it doesn't look like your normal Lou Reed. He's just sitting there with a red background and, you know, just like a V-neck shirt on or a V-neck sweater, and he looks like a grown up.
Yeah, so, he does. Like, it is
versus, you know, some of his other album art.
Yeah, it's a very kind of sober, interestingly enough, based on a song we'll probably talk about here in a minute, kind of a picture. Yeah. It really is, with the red and the yellow writing and all that. And then, of course, on the back, just the band, you know, like, looks like they're just about to do sound check or something like that on the back. But the album, I think, it definitely, like you said, has a polished kind of a sound to it.
Correct.
I don't know what your perspective is. It doesn't sound to me like Lou was trying to make a, you know, a hit album. I mean,
no.
You go back in the 70s and he had, to me, it's kind of an anomaly in the 70s, is that Sally Can't Dance album, right? Which kind of sounded a little different than the other stuff. But
right.
This does sound different, but it doesn't sound like, you know, he was immediately trying to cash in on any kind of trend or any kind of sound or write a whole bunch of hit singles.
No, I agree. We'll get to that later, because there are a couple albums in this six album run that I think he actually was trying to, you know, either make a hit album or was writing songs and producing them with that time, you know, time period's production qualities. Either attempting to cash in or just kind of going along with what everybody else was doing. But I agree. I don't think it was, you know, any kind of a cash grab or anything. I think it was just what he and his band, I think this was his long touring band, if I remember correctly. I think they'd been, you know, his touring band for a while. And, you know, they're pretty tight sounding. It's quite a bit different than the previous album, The Bells, from 1979. This one does have, again, a lot of synthesizer and a lot of keyboards, whereas The Bells was kind of more like a jazzy record. It just kind of falls flat a little bit compared to what comes up after this. And of the six, it's probably either my least favorite or second least favorite of the six. But, you know, there are some good songs. Growing Up in Public, the title track, I think is a pretty good song.
Yep.
How do you Speak to an Angel is not a bad album opener. So I don't know if there's any songs that also side two, Love Is Here to Stay, I think is a great song.
Love is here. loves to play pinball, she wants to play next. She likes her novels long, easy to comic books. They're gilded, polymorphous, urban, but somehow it works. Cause love is here, here to stay. Love is here, here to stay. It gets proven every day. Love is here, here to stay. She likes Truman Capote, he likes Gore Vidal. He likes Edgar Allan Poe, and she's into Mean Joe Green. She thinks eating meat's disgusting, he likes hot dogs. She's into Gestalt therapy, while Est and the rest just make him ill. But
love is here to stay. I like kind of like the way it wraps up. I mean, I don't know, you know, how many people are going to write a song like "Teach the Gifted Children" at the end, you know,
right,
to like say, don't let, you know, what happened to me. And, you know, I was I don't know, as they say, you know, legendarily, he was subjected to shock treatment by his parents,
right,
you know, because of the way he acted and the things he was interested in when he was a younger man. And, you know, it takes some courage to write a song like that. I don't think Lou's ever been afraid of writing any kind of song, but there's also a song on side two that was released as a single.
Which is so weird that that was, I think, was that the only single released from this album?
Yep, that was it. And it didn't really fly up the charts, as you might imagine. No. The song is called "The Power of Positive Drinking," where Lou's taking a spin on the famous book, right?
Exactly.
Self-help book. Yeah, "Power of Positive Thinking." So
right. And it's infectious, though. I can tell you
that.
Like,
yep.
You listen to it one time and you cannot stop thinking about that song, especially the hook for me is the pow, 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 power, positive drinking. Just that pow, pow, pow. It's pretty funny. I mean, again, I think it's kind of a little bit of a throwaway song.
Yeah.
And then it's really weird that he wrote that when he did, considering within a year he was clean and sober and kind of like living a totally different life than what he had done for the previous, 20 years or so, 15, 20 years.
It's amazing. It really is. And you're right. When you listen to this record, that's the one that sticks in your mind the first time. And you're like, geez. And weirdly enough, it's stuck in the middle of side two. It's not an album opener or a second side opener or anything like that. So.
Right. It's a very strange spot for a single.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of interesting, kind of perverse. But yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's probably an album he needed to make to get to the next one, most likely. And
Well, and it kind of feels like it wrapped up a part of his career. Like his life was changing. He was changing as a person, and I think internally in his his music, his muse was changing, and this kind of wrapped up that the last 3 or 4 or 5 years of what he'd been doing prior to this, to then be able to get into what he did next, which is, in my opinion, it's my favorite album of Lou Reed's. I don't know if we want any more on Growing Up in Public, but
I think that kind of does it. I mean,
yeah.
I will say that, you know, after Coney Island Baby came out in 75, I think it was, or 74, and that was commercially pretty successful, he did leave RCA and sign a contract with Arista, and he did those four albums, all of which are pretty different. But he re-signed with RCA,
right?
And then he proceeded to put out the album you mentioned, The Blue Mask.
Yeah, the next album, The Blue Mask, 1982. Just an absolutely incredible album.
Yeah.
He changed his band up. So no longer does he have a keyboardist. No longer does he have like more, you know, a somewhat of a larger band. It's literally him and three other guys. He tapped Robert Quine, who was the guitar player for Richard Hell and the Voidoids. An incredible guitarist. Obviously, you know, I knew him originally because I never got into Lou Reed early on. So I knew Robert Quine as the dude who was on Girlfriend Matthew Sweet.
Yeah.
So that was my entry to Robert Quine. And you could not have two different sounding albums than Girlfriend and The Blue Mask. Lou also brings in a person who he ends up working with for this album, and I think three more. Not the last of the 80s, but the four in the middle. And that is Fernando Saunders, who's the bass player. And he is absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
I love his bass playing. He's almost a lead bass player, especially on a lot of this album. And then as he moves forward, he kind of, you know, just bring something to the table. Like I said, I'm always kind of go towards the bass, and that's what kind of was the hook for me on this album initially, was the bass. And then new drummer, which this drummer was only on this album, and that is Doan Perry, who I guess would then end up joining Jethro Tull after this, I believe.
Weird.
Which is strange, yeah. So, but yeah, 1982's The Blue Mask. The first thing that I love about this is the cover. And it was put together by his wife, Sylvia.
Yeah.
And it is the same picture that's on the front of Transformer, or from the same session. But instead of it being yellow and black, it's blue and black.
Yeah.
And it kind of puts you in the mood of what you're going to get. It's like you look at it and you're like, my gosh, that is menacing. It is a menacing looking album cover. And it's almost scary.
Yep.
And that's kind of what you get on a decent portion of this album.
I totally agree, and I love the insight about the cover. And what I've always found kind of fascinating about it too is it's like the same font almost and size as Growing Up in Public, but underneath of it you've got that blue mask written almost like in a neon. You know, it could almost be neon. I know, it's so cool.
It is
such
so
an interesting
cool
move. Yeah,
I totally agree. And this was the one. This was one of them. The ones that I bought for $2.50.
Oh,
I'd
wow.
I'd never heard it before. I was at a thrift shop. And our secondhand shop, and I saw these this album. I'm like, I gotta buy that. It's $2, so I gotta buy it. I went home and I dropped the needle, and my brain exploded because it is awesome, and it doesn't sound like something that came from 1982.
No.
If I'm being honest, it sounds like it could have come out in 1992. Somewhere from maybe the Seattle area. I mean, I personally hear a lot of what Pearl Jam eventually ended up doing, maybe not on their first album or two, but like a little bit later on in their career.
Yep.
I think they took a lot of stuff from this record, especially the song Waves of Fear.
Absolutely.
Which is one of the greatest Lou Reed songs of all time, Waves of Fear.
Song and a lot of this album almost feels like, you know, somebody's scraping like the inside of your arms or your veins out.
No,
you know,
kidding.
It like totally empties you, and it's a gripping kind of experience. And like no matter where you are, you almost feel like suddenly it's like the middle of the night, you know, and you've woken up and you've got all these crazy nightmares or something going on in your head. And that's what he managed to translate, I think. Waves of Fear being a great example of it, but paranoia and, like you mentioned, trying to deal with a shift in his own personal situation. You know, talking about the cover, I mean, on the back, there's just that picture of that guitar that's just kind of sitting there.
Right.
And there's nothing more you really need to say about it. I mean, it's just like, this is my weapon against all these things I'm dealing with, and I'm gonna put it out there against all these forces.
Well, and Quine, I guess, had to, like, you know, kind of talk him into playing guitar.
Yep.
Because Lou really wasn't playing guitar all that much at that point. He was just like the front man of his band. And, you know, the dual guitar attack that you get on this record, it's not quite like Television's Marquee Moon, but you can hear the difference between their guitars and then the bass kind of coming in. And it's a super low sounding bass. It's like, I think he's playing that bass as low as he can possibly play it, like tuned way down.
I know it.
Oh, and you turn your bass up on your stereo and you just blast this thing and it is awesome. And what's also extremely weird is it's almost like a love letter to his wife, too. Like,
in some ways,
I think, you know, he had finally gotten clean. So it's probably the first time in a long time that he was really kind of thinking clearly and being able to put what he was really feeling at that time. And even though it is a very, like, menacing sounding album, I think he had a lot of love that he put into this record. You know, the opening track, My House, you know, it's almost like he's writing a love letter to his life that he has, and he just has this house and he's with his wife and he's so happy. But there's a lot of other things that are a little bit grimier, like track 3, Underneath the Bottle, definitely goes into, you know, alcohol, you know, alcoholism and, you know, basically his addiction to alcohol and drugs for decades.
Yeah.
The Gun, oh my gosh, it's like, it's hard to even listen to that song because you can just picture it in your mind what he's talking about. Basically, somebody has, you know, invaded your safe space and is basically holding you hostage and is threatening to kill you. And it's just haunting.
9mm Browning. Let's see what it could do. He'll point it at your mouth. Says that he'll blow your brains out. Don't you mess with me. I'm carrying a gun. Carrying a gun. Carrying a gun. Don't you mess with me. Carrying a gun. Carrying a gun. Carrying a gun. Don't mess with me, I'm carrying a gun. Get over there. Move slowly. I'll put a hole in your face if you even breathe a word. Tell the lady to lie down. I want you to be sure to see this. I wouldn't want you to miss a second. Watch your wife.
And talk about a song that, you know, like you were mentioning, that this album from 82 could have been made in the 90s. I mean, that's as relevant as anything you could think of, you know.
Exactly.
That's happening today. I mean, I'm sure it's a common nightmare. And it's interesting, at least from my perspective too, these songs that instill you, like you were saying, so much fear, and it's hard to listen to them, yet they make you feel alive. In many ways, which is really crazy. It really is
crazy. But I think it's the music. Like, they're so, like, in it. They did this all live. There's no overdubs on this record. And from what I read, they had never rehearsed. They went into the studio in 1981,
right?
And had never rehearsed. Lou had sent them some demos of the songs. They go into the studio and they do it live, no overdubs.
Wow.
From track 1 through whatever. They were working on a track or two a day. It's an incredible album. I love it so much. The Blue Mask, the actual title track, is one of the scariest tracks that I've ever heard.
It is.
Musically and lyrically. You almost can't even, like, listen to the lyrics because it's frightening.
I mean,
Talk about somebody who's unflinching when they look into their own, you know, personal experiences and mind.
Yes.
This is definitely a documentation of that. It really is. And yeah, it is really hard to believe, too, that they didn't really rehearse this stuff and they cut it all live. I mean, it's just got a raw power to it that you would think bands, you know, would kill to be able to get that kind of power, and probably stayed in the studio cutting tracks over and over and over,
exactly,
right, until the life was gone out of them to try to get a sound this powerful.
And, you know, one more song I'll highlight. Again, I love the whole album. There are a couple of songs that aren't my favorite, but I love the closer, Heavenly Arms,
yeah,
as well.
That's a great song.
And, you know, it's just a love song to his wife, and it's just incredible. I love it so much.
Heavenly arms reach out to hold me.
It's such an interesting juxtaposition for the opening track, My House, to the last song, Heavenly Arms. It is kind of a piece. And this is, I wouldn't say in any way it's like a song cycle, but it's thematically, obviously, all linked in some way or another. And it all kind of plays together and works together in a way. Yeah, in a way that, I don't know, there was just some magic and chemistry there among the musicians. And it's interesting too, and I didn't know about this at the time, and I don't know when I maybe put the connection together, but it was certainly more of an academic connection than anything else. But Robert Quine was noted early in his life for being a guy, he was well known for making some really key Velvet Underground bootlegs.
I think I knew that, yeah.
Yeah, he had been in San Francisco at a time when they were doing a residence at some club out there, and he just happened to be living there, and he brought his tape recorder every night, and they were pretty lo-fi, but they documented a period of the Velvets that had really never been documented before, and I think it's been released somewhere as a set, like they cleaned it up as much as they could. But it's interesting that he got the chance, you know, being inspired by Lou originally, and Cale and Sterling Morrison, that he got the chance to play with Lou,
yeah,
and it really brought out the best in both of them. Yeah,
I agree. I mean, this is up there with Transformer for me. It's up there with Berlin. It's up there,
yeah,
with one we'll talk about a little bit later. In my personal opinion, it's in his top five of all time. And for me, it's probably the one I go back to more than I go back to any other ones.
Yep,
I agree.
Love it as well. And just a second, what you said about Waves of Fear. I mean, it's one of the greatest Lou songs that there is. I mean, the performance, the recording, the energy, the charisma, the all the things that he ever wrote about in his career come together. It deserves to be right up there with the Velvet songs. It does.
He's unhinged when he's singing on that song.
Yeah.
It's just he let it all go.
Yeah.
And you could tell, and it's almost like it just, his whole being at that time seeped into the tape and then comes out of your speakers and goes right into you.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is a jewel in an incredible record.
So yeah, after the Blue Mask, he kept the same band, other than the drummer changed because he left for Jethro Tull again, like we said, which was a little bit weird, but still had Robert Quine on guitar and Fernando Saunders on bass, and then Fred Mayer joins on drums. I think that's how his name is pronounced. I'm not sure.
I believe so.
It doesn't really let up. The drums on this are incredible, and I know he plays on at least one later on in these. I'm not sure. I think he might have played on the next one as well. But same band, but and the album is called Legendary Hearts, if I forgot to say that. There was one problem, though, is that Lou, being Lou, you know, I think there was a quote, something like, I think Robert Quine had said something like the first hour and a half were good with Lou or something like that.
Yeah.
Because Lou, I guess, was always known as being, you know, not a very nice person and not very easy to work with. So there was some issues between Robert Quine and Reed, I believe, or Lou. I think it had something to do with maybe writing credits. I think Robert Quine had written a hook on a song, but didn't get any of the credits. So what Lou does is he mixes Robert Quine so far down in the mix that it's almost just Lou Reed and a bass player and a drummer.
Crazy.
For most of the record. So me personally, and we were talking about this before we went on air, if Robert Quine's guitars were up in the mix, I think this could be right up there with the Blue Mask.
Agree.
The songs are there. The songs are incredible. You know, Lou is still like really in it. His mind is clear. And, you know, a lot of the things that he talks about on this record, it's another love letter to his wife. You know, it's all there. It's just the production doesn't sound as good to me as I think the Blue Mask did.
Completely 100% agree with you. And I think it's interesting. I mean, I was reading, I forget where I read this, but when Robert Quine got a tape or a test pressing, I can't remember what it was.
It was literally a cassette,
right? He just took it out in his driveway and smashed it like with a hammer or something like that.
And supposedly, I've heard that he has or had, obviously he's passed away, but he had a copy of the mixes that, you know, like the original mixes with him in it.
Right.
And supposedly it sounded awesome. So
yeah.
I don't know the truth to that, obviously, but I would love to hear that. If that exists, I would love to hear that.
I hope that, you know, it comes out. I know that his last wife, Laurie Anderson, is embarking on some kind of project, right, where it's going to be unearthing some material from his archive. So maybe that would be one. And I think that would be really appropriate, because I think this album, at least for me, has grown in stature since Lou's passing. And when you look at the whole canon of work that he did, it does rise, because it, I think, indicated that it wasn't just a one-shot, you know, thing, that the Blue Mask came out and Lou, you know, got all these demons out there and suddenly here was this ferocious record, and then he was going back to be, you know, kind of hit and miss or whatever it was. But it was, you know, truly he was still at the peak of his artistic powers in many ways, and the songs that he wrote I think reflected that. They're very honest. They show kind of a especially if you take a song like, it's not my super favorite song in the album, but if you take a song like Rooftop Garden that ends the record, it sort of shows him thinking about another way of living from what he had done in the past, right?
Right.
And there's this old kind of another chapter of life, or another like turn he was taking that leads to this road. He doesn't know where it's going, but he knows it's going to be there. And that's a lot, you know, from the place he was coming from to the place he got to in the space of, gosh, what was it, like really only 2 years or something like that.
Right.
You know,
exactly. Well, and I read something somewhere. I can't find it at this point. I'm kind of doing some research as we're talking, but I read something somewhere where there's a theory that this is kind of a Romeo and Juliet type of a story.
Oh, really?
But I can't remember exactly the songs. I think it's Legendary Hearts into either like Betrayed and Bottoming Out. But then finally at the end, they get together and they're sitting on the rooftop garden and everything is fine, versus the way Romeo and Juliet actually happened.
Sitting in our rooftop garden, looking down below. Sitting in our rooftop garden, waiting for the sun. What a lovely couple are you and I. Sitting in our rooftop garden, a few drops of rain. The lights in the city blinking on, just the same. No sugar with my coffee, how's your tea? In our rooftop garden above the city.
But, you know, talking about rooftop garden, this was another, this was one of the six of these albums that I was less familiar with than the others. And I think one thing that kind of triggered my brain to do this podcast again was Bonnie Prince Billy and Bill Callahan put out Blind Date Party last year. And there's a cover of Rooftop Garden on
oh,
there.
Oh, is there really? Done, I didn't know that.
Done with, I can't remember his name. He's a Greek musician. And it sounds totally different.
Wow.
It's not even close to the same song, but it is a fascinating listen. So I would highly recommend anybody out there to look up Blind Date Party and listen to Rooftop Garden. It's really cool. I played on my Rockin' Suburbs radio show. I had a working man's blues show one time after yep. vacation, and I played Don't Talk to Me About Work, and it's kind of a throwaway song, but it's a fun song. I love listening to that song. It's definitely not, you know, not Waves of Fear or The Blue Mask, but it's definitely a fun song to listen to. And you know, Betrayed, there's some really, really deep songs on here, and you know, I can't even think of the word. There's a lot to kind of pick through and a lot to, you know, think about listening to some of these songs. It's not like a surface record. This is one that you have to listen to and just kind of pick through and dig through and find what he's talking about. And it's very deep.
I totally agree. And the song for me on this one is Martial Law.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking of this kind of stuff, you know, like back when he was, it's kind of amazing. And that's another reason I think, you know, it's a great juxtaposition between like Don't Talk to Me About Work and a song like Martial Law, or even Bottoming Out or Legendary Hearts, where he's able to land his mind on a song like Don't Talk to Me About Work, and in the same sort of cerebral space he can write a song that's really deep, like you said, and has all these layers and comes from a place that's almost like beyond intuition in a way. I mean, Martial Law is a great, great song. I love that. It's probably my favorite on this record.
Well, and it just goes to show you how great of a songwriter he was.
Yes.
You know, back in his early days with Pickwick Records, he was, you know, almost like a Brill Building type of a songwriter, and he was just churning out songs like 15 to 20 songs a week. And I guess for Pickwick, he basically was what do they call it? I can't remember what it was called, but like, you know, a record label would put out a band called the Beatles with B-E-E-T-L-E-S. And he would write songs that sounded like the Beatles you know, it was crazy, but he was just an incredible songwriter and could do anything.
Going back a little bit to this record, I think, it's one of those ones that definitely deserves to be reevaluated, especially if you're a Lou fan and maybe you listened to it a couple times or when it came out or something, you know, or even if you never heard it. But it is one you can pick up, you know, if you search those $3 bins and things like that, you can find it in the used shops for a pretty reasonable price, and it's more than worth it, I think.
Yeah, this is one I don't have. I definitely need to pick this one up. So I need to dig through the R bins and or the $3 bins and see if I can locate a copy. I love the album cover too.
I was just gonna say it.
Yeah,
it presages a little bit. The one that follows it up, but
right, exactly,
especially with a couple of the songs on there. But I love it too. I mean, the motorcycle helmet and then the little sort of image of Lou on the left side in the visor is great.
Yeah.
And it does say right on the back, you know, to Sylvia. So it's another one where he's really dedicating a lot of that time and space to to her. Yeah, and what she provided to him at that point in his life. Now I will make a little addendum to this period really quick is, there was, an album and I looked it up here. It's called Live in Italy. It was never released in the United States. It was recorded on September 7th and September 10th of the year 1983, and Legendary Hearts was released in March. So, most likely it was part of the tour, I think, that, that was supporting Legendary Hearts. Yeah, because it features the same band that was on the record. And just that quartet, stripped down quartet. And you look at the track listing, and the first side, it's a four-sided record. You get Sweet Jane, I'm Waiting for the Man, Martial Law, and then Satellite of Love.
Man, that's a good side.
Yeah, and then you get Kill Your Sons, Waves of Fear, Average Guy on side two, then Some Kind of Love and Sister Ray, 15 Minutes medley, and then Walk on the Wild Side, Heroin and Rock and Roll closes it out. And here, Quine's guitar is blasted because there's no way for Lou to mix it out, you know, at the end. It definitely hints at what the power of the band was, and no matter what the issues were between Lou and the rest of them, you know, it shows when they got up on stage and just recorded. It was very, very powerful.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Cool. So great. So we'll go on and talk about next three in this 80s set. Also want to say, if anybody has anything to say about this period of Lou Reed, please get in touch. You can send us an email, rock@suburbspod.com. You can find us on the social medias at suburbspod, pretty much on all those channels. And you can always stick your head out the window and yell, and somebody will come eventually. But we're going to go into the next episode here, and we're going to pick it up with a record that came out in 1984. That's going to be tomorrow.
Yep.
And I want to thank everybody for listening. Thank you, Scott, very much for this. Yeah, absolutely. I am Patrick Foster.
And I am Scott Parks.
And we will talk to you guys tomorrow.
They tied his arms behind his back to teach him how to swim.
I know of it, I've never listened to it, and I want it.